Welcome to another episode of Morning Coffee with your host, Rick Alexander. I started this show to talk about all of the interesting, complex, paradoxical, and sometimes uncomfortable aspects of the human experience. If you get anything from this show, the greatest compliment you could give me is to share this show with somebody that you think the message may resonate with, or to head to iTunes and give us a 5-star review. Additionally, if you want to interact with me, you can follow me at @RickAlexander_ on Instagram. Without further ado, on to the show. Monday. Welcome back to the Morning Coffee Podcast. Today I'm going to do something a little bit different. In honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I decided that I would just read one of his sermons. At the end, I will offer some reflections on it and some things that came up for me throughout it. But I thought the best thing I could do today was kind of just step aside and let one of the best do what he does. What's interesting, something worth considering for you, is that there are times in your life where certain people will speak to you. There's something in your soul, you'll feel an expansion of self whenever you hear it. And it would behoove you to listen to those people, to spend more time consuming what they're saying. It's all too easy to listen to a good author or a good speaker or something along those lines, and then project all of the good qualities that you like onto them, and then dismiss those same things in yourself. And the result being that you don't get closer to who you're here to be. Because what actually happens when you hear something that resonates with you on a soul level is that it's trying to wake something up in yourself, right? Most of our lives, our soul is sort of in this slumber, and we need something to wake it up, to cause that expansion. And you feel it within you. What's interesting, probably based on my personal kind of archetype in life, I started reading the work of Martin Luther King Jr. this summer, and I'd never felt a soul expansion like I did when I was reading it. And it was really one of the catalysts that sent me on this path of really just being an aspiring lover. And what I mean by that is, like, yeah, I've got all the same predilections. I've been a hateful person for much of my life. And I realized in reading his work that, like, I was on a road that I could not win. Like, it was a road that leads to destruction. And you look out in the world today, and there are so many people that are trying to replicate violence. They're trying to hate their way out of their problems. And unfortunately, when it comes to something like unity, love is the only option we have. And it's super difficult. I'll get into some more comments at the end, but I hope you enjoy this sermon by Martin Luther King Jr. It is called Loving Your Enemies. Probably no admonition of Jesus has been more difficult to follow than the command to love your enemies. Some people have sincerely felt that its actual practice is not possible. It's easy, they say, to love those who love you, but how can one love those who openly and insidiously seek to defeat you? Others, like the philosopher Nietzsche, contend that Jesus' exhortation to love one's enemies is testimony to the fact that the Christian ethic is designed for the weak and the cowardly, and not for the strong and courageous. Jesus, they say, was an impractical idealist. In spite of these insistent questions and persistent objections, the command of Jesus challenges us with new urgency. Upheaval after upheaval has reminded us that the modern man is traveling along a road called hate, in a journey that will bring us to destruction and damnation. Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, the command to love one's enemies is an absolute necessity for our survival. Love, even for enemies, is the key to the solution of the problems of our world. Jesus is not an impractical idealist. He is the practical realist. I'm certain that Jesus understood the difficulty inherent in the act of loving one's enemies. He never joined the ranks of those who talk glibly about the easiness of the moral life. He realized that every genuine expression of love grows out of consistent and total surrender to God. So when Jesus said, "Love your enemy," he was not unmindful of its stringent qualities, yet he meant every word of it. Our responsibility as Christians is to discover the meaning of this command and seek passionately to live it out in our daily lives. Let us be practical and ask the question, how do we love our enemies? First, we must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. He who is devoid of the power to forgive is devoid of the power to love. It is impossible even to begin the act of loving one's enemies without the prior acceptance of the necessity, over and over again, of forgiving those who inflict evil and injury upon us. It is also necessary to realize that the forgiving act must always be initiated by the person who has been wronged. The victim of some great hurt, the recipient of some torturous injustice, the absorber of some terrible act of oppression, the wrongdoer may request forgiveness. He may come to himself and, like the prodigal son, move up some dusty road, his heart palpitating with desire for forgiveness. But only the injured neighbor, the loving father back home, can really pour out the warm waters of forgiveness. Forgiveness does not mean ignoring what has been done or putting a false label on an evil act. It means, rather, that the evil act no longer remains as a barrier to the relationship. Forgiveness is a catalyst, creating the atmosphere necessary for a fresh start and a new beginning. It is the lifting of a burden or the canceling of a debt. The words, "I will forgive you, but I'll never forget what you've done," never explain the real nature of forgiveness. Certainly one can never forget, if that means erasing it totally from his mind. But when we forget in the sense that the evil deed is no longer a mental block impeding a relationship. Likewise, we can never say, "I will forgive you, but I won't have anything further to do with you." Forgiveness means reconciliation, a coming together. Without this, no man can love his enemies. The degree to which we're able to forgive determines the degree to which we're able to love our enemies. Second, we must recognize that the evil deed of the enemy neighbor, the thing that hurts, never quite expresses all that he is. An element of goodness may be found even in our worst enemy. Each of us is something of a schizophrenic personality, tragically divided against ourselves. A persistent civil war rages within all of our lives. Something within us causes us to lament with Ovid, the Latin poet, "I see and approve the better things, but follow the worse." Or to agree with Plato, the human personality is like a charioteer, having two headstrong horses, each wanting to go in a different direction. Or to repeat with the Apostle Paul, "The good that I would, I do not, but the evil which I would not, that I do." This simply means that there is something good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we are less prone to hate our enemies. When we look beneath the surface, beneath the impulsive evil deed, we see within our enemy neighbor a measure of goodness and know that the viciousness and evilness of his acts are not quite representative of all that he is. We see him in a new light. We recognize that his hate grows out of fear, pride, ignorance, prejudice, and misunderstanding. But in spite of all of this, we know God's image is ineffably etched into his being. Then we love our enemies by realizing that they are not totally bad and that they are not beyond the reach of God's redemptive love. Third, we must not seek to defeat or humiliate the enemy, but to win his friendship and understanding. At times, we're able to humiliate our worst enemy. Inevitably, his weak moments come and we're able to thrust in his side the spear of defeat. But this we must not do. Every word and deed must contribute to an understanding with the enemy and release those vast reservoirs of goodwill that have been blocked by impenetrable walls of hate. The meaning of love is not to be confused with some sentimental outpouring. Love is something much deeper than emotional bosh. Perhaps the Greek language can clear our confusion at this point. In the Greek New Testament are three words for love. The word eros is sort of aesthetic or romantic love. In the Platonic dialogues, eros is a yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. The second word is philia, a reciprocal love, and the intimate affection and friendship between friends. We love those whom we like, and we love because we are loved. The third word is agape, understanding and creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. An overflowing love that seeks nothing in return, agape is the love of God operating in the human heart. At this level, we love men not because we like them, nor because their ways appeal to us, nor even because they process some type of divine spark. We love every man because God loves him. At this level, we love the person who does an evil deed, although we hate the deed that he does. Now we can see what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. We should be happy that he did not say, like your enemies. It's almost impossible to like some people. Like is a sentimental and affectionate word. How can we be affectionate toward a person whose vowed aim is to crush our very being and place innumerable stumbling blocks in our path? How can we like a person who is threatening our children and bombing our homes? That is impossible. But Jesus recognized that love is greater than like. When Jesus bids us to love our enemies, he's speaking neither of eros nor philia. He is speaking of agape, understanding and creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. Only by following this way and responding with this type of love are we able to be children of our Father who is in heaven. Let us move now from the practical how to the theoretical why. Why should we love our enemies? The first reason is fairly obvious. Returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction. So when Jesus says, love your enemies, he is setting forth a profound and ultimately inescapable admonition. Have we not come to such an impasse in the modern world that we must love our enemies or else? The chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation. Another reason why we must love our enemies is that hate scars the soul and distorts the personality. Mindful that hate is an evil and dangerous force, we too often think of what it does to the person hated. This is understandable. For hate brings irreparable damage to its victims. We've seen its ugly consequence in the ignominious death brought to 6 million Jews by a hate-obsessed madman named Hitler, in the unspeakable violence inflicted upon black people by bloodthirsty mobs, in the dark horrors of war, and in the terrible indignities and injustice perpetrated against millions of God's children by unconscionable oppressors. But there is another side that we must never overlook. Hate is just as injurious to the person who hates. Like an unchecked cancer, hate corrodes the personality and eats away at its vital unity. Hate destroys a man's sense of values and his objectivity. It causes him to describe the beautiful as ugly and the ugly as beautiful, and to confuse the true with the false and the false with the true. Dr. Franklin Frazier, in an interesting essay entitled The Pathology of Race Prejudice, included several examples of white persons who were normal, amiable, and congenial in their day-to-day relationships with other white persons, but when they were challenged to think of black people as equals or even to discuss the question of racial injustice, they reacted with unbelievable irrationality and an abnormal unbalance. And this happens when hate lingers in our minds. Psychiatrists report that many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious, many of our inner conflicts are rooted in hate. They say love or perish. Modern psychology recognizes what Jesus taught centuries ago. Hate divides the personality, and love is an amazing and inexorable way to unite it. A third reason why we should love our enemies is that love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds up. Love transforms with redemptive power. Lincoln tried love and left for all history a magnificent drama of reconciliation. When he was campaigning for the presidency, one of his arch enemies was a man named Stanton. For many reasons, Stanton hated Lincoln. He used every ounce of his energy to degrade him in the eyes of the public. So deep-rooted was Stanton's hate for Lincoln that he uttered unkind words about his physical appearance and sought to embarrass him at every point with the bitterest diatribes. But in spite of this, Lincoln was elected President of the United States. Then came the period when he had to select his cabinet, which would consist of the persons who would be his most intimate associates in implementing his program. He started choosing men here and there for the various secretaryships. The day finally came for Lincoln to select a man to fill the all-important post of Secretary of War. Can you imagine whom Lincoln chose to fill this post? None other than the man named Stanton. There was an immediate uproar in the inner circle when the news began to spread. Advisor after advisor was heard saying, "Mr. President, you are making a mistake. Do you know this man, Stanton? Are you familiar with all of the ugly things he said about you? He is your enemy. He will seek to sabotage your program. Have you thought this through, Mr. President?" Mr. Lincoln's answer was terse and to the point. "Yes, I know Mr. Stanton. I'm aware of all the terrible things he has said about me. But after looking over the nation, I find he is the best man for the job." So Stanton became Abraham Lincoln's Secretary of War and rendered an invaluable service to his nation and his president. Not many years later, Lincoln was assassinated. Many laudable things were said about him. Even today, millions of people still adore him as the greatest of all Americans. H.G. Wells selected him as one of the 6 great men of history. But of all the great statements made about Abraham Lincoln, the words of Stanton remain amongst the greatest. Standing near the dead body of the man he once hated, Stanton referred to him as one of the greatest men that had ever lived and said he now belongs to the ages. If Lincoln had hated Stanton, both men would have gone to their graves as bitter enemies. But through the power of love, Lincoln transformed an enemy into a friend. It was this same attitude that made it possible for Lincoln to speak a kind word about the South during the Civil War, when feeling was most bitter. Asked by a shocked bystander how he could do this, Lincoln said, "Madam, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? This is the power of redemptive love." We must hasten to say that these are not the ultimate reasons why we should love our enemies. An even more basic reason why we are commanded to love is expressed explicitly in Jesus' words, "Love your enemies, that ye may be children of your Father which is in heaven." We are called to this difficult task to realize a unique relationship with God. We are potential sons of God. Through love, that potentiality becomes actuality. We must love our enemies, because only by loving them can we know God and experience the beauty of His holiness. The relevance of what I have said to this crisis in race relations should be readily apparent. There will be no permanent solution to the race problem until oppressed men develop the capacity to love their enemies. The darkness of racial injustice will be displayed only by the light of forgiving love. For more than 3 centuries, African Americans have been battered by the iron rod of oppression, frustrated by day and bewildered by night by unbearable justice, and burdened with the ugly weight of discrimination. Forced to live with these shameful conditions, we are tempted to become bitter and to retaliate with a corresponding hate. But if this happens, the new order we seek will be little more than a duplicate of the old order. We must, in strength and humility, meet hate with love. Of course, this is not practical. Life is a matter of getting even, of hitting back, of dog-eat-dog. Am I saying that Jesus commands us to love those who hurt and oppress us? Do I sound like most preachers, idealistic and impractical? Maybe in some distant utopia, you say, that idea will work, but not in the hard, cold war in which we live. My friends, we have followed the so-called practical way for too long a time now, and it has led inexorably to deeper confusion and chaos. Time is cluttered with a wreckage of communities that surrender to hatred and violence. For the salvation of our nation and the salvation of mankind, we must follow another way. That does not mean that we abandon our righteous efforts. With every ounce of our energy, we must continue to rid this nation of the incubus of segregation. But we shall not, in the process, relinquish our privilege and our obligation to love. While abhorring segregation, we shall love the segregationist. This is the only way to create the beloved community. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as it is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour, and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves, we shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Love is the most durable power in the world. This creative force so beautifully exemplified in the life of our Christ, is the most potent instrument available in mankind's quest for peace and security. Napoleon Bonaparte, the great military genius, looking back over his years of conquest, is reported to have said, "Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have built great empires. But upon what did they depend? They depended on force. But centuries ago, Jesus started an empire that was built on love, and even to this day, millions will die for him." Who can doubt the veracity of these words? The great military leader of the past have gone, and their empires have crumbled and burned to ashes. But the empire of Jesus, built solidly and majestically on the foundation of love, is still growing. It started with a small group of dedicated men who, through the inspiration of their Lord, were able to shake the hinges from the gates of the Roman Empire and carry the gospel into all the world. Today, the vast earthly kingdom of Christ numbers more than 900 million and covers every land and tribe. Today we hear again the promise of victory. Jesus is eternal light. History is replete with the bleached bones of nations that refuse to listen to him. May we in the 20th century hear and follow his words before it is too late. May we solemnly realize that we shall never be true sons of our Heavenly Father until we love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. Just wanted to offer a couple reflections and things that stood out for me as I was reading that sermon. One is, he had all these sermons that were often requested that people really liked, and you've probably heard different quotes about, you know, there's one in there about hate driving out hate and only love can do that, and you've seen those probably replicated. Well, what happened is he took all of his most popular, most requested sermons and put them into a book, and he called it Strength to Love. And so I wanted to talk about why he called it Strength to Love, and that is specifically because he recognized how difficult it actually is. There's a line in there where he says, "We must in strength and humility meet hate with love." Something that's important to know about him is that he struggled immensely with this idea. His wife, Loretta, talked a lot about how in the middle of the night he would be so distraught and like feel so much pressure from what he was doing. Like he would go out to the kitchen table and just pray that somebody would just take that cup from him, right? Take that away from him, like take that burden away from him. And so the reason he called it strength to love is because he recognized something in that, which is how much strength it actually takes to love. You know, there's a point in there where he's like kind of just saying, do what you want. Like you can do whatever you can to me, but we will not stop loving you. I also like how he makes the distinction between like and love, right? Because I think that we are under the delusion in our world today where we have to understand each other to love each other, or we have to like each other to love each other. And I just don't think that's true. I think that we can love each other based on the sacred bond of being human. And that if we are able to do that, we can unite against all kinds of oppressive forces. We can unite against bad leaders. You know, we can unite against all of the things that seek to divide us. But under the guise and delusion of the fact that we have to agree, then we're always just waiting to agree, and it's almost impossible to do. And of course, when someone disagrees with you, it's like everything in you is pissed, right? Everything in you, when you watch the news, whatever it is, the other side, everything within you is like wanting to send that hate back their way. And so the reason he called it strength of love is because it is so damn difficult to actually do. Right? To realize that who you are is not dependent on who they are, right? And what's interesting is that by you serving that light in people, like if you look at people as if there's light in them, you'll see theirs grow. And so there's a point in there where he talks about, you know, not only are we going to save ourselves by loving you, but we're going to save you too. We're going to save you from the hate that you're stuck inside of. And that's what I wanted to end with, is the idea that love is healing, acceptance, belonging. These things are very healing. And actually, you can't heal if you don't have that, right? Many of the fractures in our psyche take place because we don't have the belonging, the safety, the security to actually heal them. And so something within our body is so uptight and so protective of those things that it's actually only love that can heal these problems. And so he talks about if you give in to hate, there's a disfiguring aspect of it. Like it actually just ruins who you are. It's like swallowing a poison pill and trying to kill your enemies. Right? It just doesn't work. It's going to ruin who you are. And so, yeah, though it's difficult, I think we're in this place now where we're like, as he said, like almost marching toward annihilation because we're under the guise that we can hate our way out of this one. And we cannot. It will not happen, right? It's only going to replicate the problem. The only thing that is going to drive out darkness in this world is light. Unfortunately, it takes a lot of strength to embody that light. Anyway, I love you guys. I hope you have an amazing day. We'll talk tomorrow, starting a four-part series. I'm actually going to do four teachings out of my new book, Ambitious Heroes and Heartache. So stay tuned for that. We'll talk later on Morning Coffee.